Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
And your pub quiz question is, what connects all of those songs? Well, they're all hits that featured in major films. And here to tell us more about the business of the big screen soundtracks, I'm joined by Adam Maguire from the RTE Business Desk. Hello.
How are you?
What lovely music we have to accompany us this morning. There are many songs, though, that just wouldn't exist. Isn't that right?
Yeah,
if it wasn't for film.
And all of those songs that were played there were made for the film. Weren't just featured in film. So, you know, and so many brilliant, iconic songs when you think about it. So like, we heard there Staying Alive by the Bee Gees, which is, of course, Saturday Night Live, Saturday Night Fever, Mrs. Robinson by Simon and Garfunkel for The Graduate. Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds was actually written for The Breakfast Club, but I thought it was a song that they just used.
They used it,
No, it was written for it. And of course, Purple Rain by Prince for Purple Rain, the greatest song of all time. And then there's plenty of maybe not so classic songs, but ones that, you know, we'll all know. My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion for Titanic. Everything I Do, Brian Adams for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
God, I remember that. That's awesome. So well.
16 weeks at number
16 weeks. I remember every one of them.
You could not get away from that song. Yeah, really. It's scarred into the brain. Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith, which was for Armageddon. Another song that just didn't go away for that whole summer, as I remember it. And then we have the modern examples we heard there, like What Was I Made For by Billie Eilish, which was for the Barbie movie. Pharrell Williams doing Happy for Despicable Me 2. And like what you see here basically is a movie studio looking to tie a film to a big artist. Could it add another kind of element of exposure to the release? Maybe gives them a bit of kind of artistic credibility or catchiness, and it, you know, creates positive association for audiences. They like the song, they want to go and see the film, and, you know, they like the film, they want to listen to the song. But it is increasingly important for artists as well, because, you know, even for the bigger names now, it's getting harder and harder to find an opportunity to get your song out there and to make money from a song as well. So putting it on a soundtrack means you're getting paid by the studio first and foremost, which is nice, but it'll also get heard by probably millions of people who go and see the film, and then they go and check out maybe the rest of your work, and maybe they become a fan and they buy the t-shirt and they go to the gig. Back in 2012, Soundgarden's first new release in 15 years was connected to the Marvel Avengers movie, and the late Chris Cornell said it was now the way to get your music in front of a new audience, because you didn't have a big record label pushing you anymore. You had to do this instead. This is how you get in front of people. And then, of course, you know, there are cases where you have existing songs that were picked up for a movie soundtrack and they become linked to them forever. So Everybody's Talking by Harry Nilsson, for example, that came out 2 years before Midnight Cowboy, but everybody thinks of that film when they hear that song. All Star by Smash Mouth wasn't actually written for any film, but it got used by many of them in Mystery Men, Rat Race, and then Shrek. It became a huge hit and it's still loved to this day because it was in Shrek, even though it wasn't written for it.
And always associated with Shrek as a result. We have another one now to listen to. This wasn't written for a film, but it did become a hit because of one. That's Kiss From A Rose by Seal. And there's a great story behind this one, Adam, is there?
Yeah, there really is. So Seal would have burst onto the scene with his self-titled debut album in 91. People might remember the huge hits Killer and Crazy. And 3 years later, he followed up with a second album, which he also called Seal, confusingly, but people refer to it as Seal 2. And it had Kiss From A Rose on it. But that was actually written in 87. So it was a really old song by the time it actually came out. And it didn't do very well at all. It did okay in the UK. Kiss From A Rose was one of the singles. did all right, then fell off the charts very quickly. And according to Seal, he reckoned he was very close to his the record label dropping him because he just wasn't performing well at all. But then he gets a call from a filmmaker called Joel Schumacher, who had made films like St. Elmo's Fire, The Lost Boys, Falling Down, and he had also been tasked with picking up the Batman franchise after Tim Burton's first two, which had starred Michael Keaton. And Schumacher said he was a fan of Seal. He said, "Can I use Kiss from a Rose for a love scene that involves Bruce Wayne and Nicole Kidman's
he
character?"
Said yes.
Yeah, Dr. Chase Meridian. And of course Seal said, "Yes, work away, please do." But then Schumacher came back and said, "Look, it doesn't really work in that scene, but I like the song, so I'm going to stick it on the end," basically.
Oh, disappointing.
Yeah, well, you think so. But Seal said what that meant was you had millions of people around the world go and see this big blockbuster film. The last thing they hear as they're walking out is Kiss from a Rose. It's the last thing ringing in their ears that sticks in their head. And it becomes a huge, massive global hit. Makes a huge amount of money for Seal, and it saves his musical career in the process. And he's still going to this day because of that.
There you go. Now, another band that were on the verge of being dropped by their record label until a movie saved them. I love this one. This is Survivor.
Yeah, and Eye of the Tiger. Now, you know, again, wasn't written, or it was written specifically for a movie, but what people might think, they think of Rocky. It was actually Rocky 3 that it was written for. So, you know, it's so iconic, it's just linked to the whole franchise, really. They had two albums out by the time Eye of the Tiger was made. Neither had done well. They were convinced, again, the record label was going to give them the boot. They got a phone call down from Sylvester Stallone, who wanted a punchy song for a montage scene in his new Rocky film. And something that comes up time and again with these stories is that there's a huge amount of luck here, because Stallone originally had tried to get Another One Bites the Dust by Queen for this montage. They had said no, so he had to go looking for an alternative. So he went to Survivor, asked him for something with a strong beat that would kind of match up with the punches in the montage, and Eye of the Tiger is the result. And of course, a huge hit, an anthem. You know, people still immediately recognise it from the opening guitar line. And it became the name of Survivor's third album. They went on to have 8 albums in total. The last one came out in 2006, so they're still going until relatively recently. A lot of longevity. You know, and you wonder what would have happened had Queen said yes to Another One Bites the Dust being used. Survivor possibly just would have disappeared and we'd never hear from them again.
Saved by Rocky.
Saved by Rocky, yeah.
We've another immediately recognisable song now to hear. This is one where the lawyers ended up getting involved, though, and it was the song from Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters! There's something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters! There's something weird and it don't look good. Who you gonna call?
So catchy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even still.
Yeah, this is 1984, Ray Parker Jr. for the Ghostbusters film. Again, very recognisable to this day. But the producers of the film had initially gone to Huey Lewis. They wanted him to make a song for the Ghostbusters movie. He declined, probably because he was already signed up to make another song for another film, Back to the Future and The Power of Love, which was another great song. He was a busy man. So despite that, though, the producers used his song, I Need a New Drug, as their kind of temporary background track when they were filming and editing the scenes, just as a reference for the footage. And then they went to Ray Parker Jr. And said, "Right, we want you to make a song. Here's the scenes. Here's what we've edited. We also used this song, I Need a New Drug, as the background, so just to give you a reference point. And also, can you get the word Ghostbusters in there somehow as well, please?" So he was given he was kind of the last resort. They had also gone to Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac and asked him, and he said no. So he didn't have much time. He had about a weekend to turn this song around with all of those kind of guidelines. So he comes along with the song that we know today, which does bear more than a passing resemblance to I Need a New Drug by Huey Lewis and the News. Huey Lewis certainly thought so. Anyway, he launched a plagiarism case. It was settled out of court and he got royalties for the song. But there is another twist in the tale, because part of that settlement was a confidentiality clause. Fast forward to 2001, Lewis tells the story to VH1, which prompts Parker to sue Lewis because he breached the confidentiality agreement. And that results in Ray Parker Jr. getting some money out of the Ghostbusters song after all in the end.
Back at you, yeah. Huey Lewis.
He got his revenge.
Well, we have to hear it now, don't we?
Yeah,
we have
to
hear
the
I Need a New Drug from Huey Lewis.
And further into that song you get, the more it sounds like the Ghostbusters song.
Like, yeah. I mean, Ray Parker Jr., I mean, come on.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, like, he made a great song, but it was very, very heavily inspired by Huey Lewis.
I was tempted to suggest that Huey was being, you know, a little bit petty there when he's making so much money from The Power of Love.
Yeah.
But
no,
when you hear
no,
that,
I think
you kind of go,
yeah,
justified. What about the songs that were made hits, though, by TV shows?
Yeah, this is and I think this is a phenomenon that's kind of confined to the 90s in a way, because, you know, traditionally TV shows had theme tunes rather than using pop songs. That did start to become more common in the 80s. Think of the Golden Girls, for example. But it wasn't really until the 90s you had this kind of perfect storm of a global TV audience, physical sales reaching their peak. It's very easy to go out and buy your tape or your CD. And then you have pop songs being used. So the best example probably is of a TV show creating a hit is Friends, and I'll Be There For You by the Rembrandts. And again, we see an element of luck here, because the pilot of Friends, which was initially called Friends Like Us, was using Shiny Happy People by R.E.M. as its theme tune. But R.E.M. Said they didn't want to be on a TV show. So instead, Martha Kaufman and David Crane, which are two of the creators behind Friends, teamed up with Ali Williams, who co-wrote Boogie Wonderland in September for Earth, Wind & Fire. So a very seasoned hit writer. But they made a 45-second song. Just for the theme, then Warner Brothers, which was the record label as well as the TV studio, scratched around and looked for a band. They found this band, the Rembrandts, that were on their books and said, "You record this for us."
Lucky Rembrandts.
Yeah, hugely lucky. And it became obviously a huge hit. People fell in love with it. That led to the band then having to go and write extra verses to stretch it out into a 3-minute song. It's not known how much they made from it. It's probably in the millions, though, and they're still making money from it now, because I think Friends makes the guts of $1 billion a year still, in streaming rights and, you know, licensing and all that stuff. The actors
wait,
get a huge amount of that.
I pick my jaw up off the table.
I know, yeah,
really.
Incredible. Like, I mean, the show ended, it must be close to 20 years ago now, is it, that it ended? But the band probably still getting a couple of quid for the song that features at the start of it as well.
There's another 90s gem, music heyday gem, I Don't Want to Wait.
Yeah, this is Paula Cole, which was written for a 96 album. It then got picked up for use on TV show Dawson's Creek. And again, there's a bit of luck here, because initially the producers wanted Hand in My Pocket by Alanis Morissette. She decided she didn't want that song to be used, so again, they had to go looking for a last minute replacement. And it's Warner Brothers again. They suggest, well, look, we have the license for this song by Paula Cole, and the rest is history. It gets used. And while Cole did make some money for that and sold albums and gig tickets and all the rest on the back of it, she hasn't really gotten any royalties for the song in a good few years now, because the creators stopped using the song on DVD releases and then on streaming releases. They put another song in to save money, so they didn't have to pay her royalties. She's now re-recorded and published her own version of the song, which is kind of Taylor Swift style, you know, Taylor's version kind of thing. Ask people to choose that one when they're downloading it over the original. And Netflix has also struck a deal with her directly. So they're streaming the show. They've put her new version in as the theme tune, which has made the fans happy, because it's just like the old times. It's the original theme tune rather than the one that they dropped in to try and save a few quid.
Good for you, Paula Cole. Well done. Happy for you. What about the composers? Because they have a role to play, of course.
Oh, yeah,
as well.
Totally. Yeah, and so many cases where a song soundtrack is iconic because of theme music that's created for it rather than songs. So, you know, some people might disagree. I think John Williams, though, is the king of the iconic theme tune. So he's responsible for the music from Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Superman, Jurassic Park, E.T., Jaws, Schindler's List, Harry Potter, Home Alone. Done lots of other films besides those, but people will immediately recognise those theme tunes. Which, you know, he probably raised an eyebrow, though. Recently he said he doesn't really like film music very much.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and his complaint is that, you know, they tend to be kind of fragments or fleeting, unlike something composed for an opera or symphony. And I suppose he has a point, because those films all have iconic moments, you know, the kind of Star Wars, you know, the burst of music or the Superman theme. But, you know, most of a film soundtrack is designed to be in the background, kind of sitting under and not interrupting the dialogue or the action, not distracting you. So it's meant to kind of just be, you know, literally
wallpaper.
Background music, kind of wallpaper, yeah. Still, though, loads of really beloved film composers out there working today. Hans Zimmerman, Danny Elfman, probably best known for his work with Tim Burton. Ennio Morricone, Howard Shore, Vangelis, Quincy Jones is in a lot of soundtracks. One example I really love, I'm a fan of, Trent Reznor, is the man behind Nine Inch Nails. He's developed a hugely, hugely successful career as a film score composer with Atticus Ross. And I think it's remarkable, because when he started out in the 90s or the 80s, he was singing about really dark stuff, you know, addiction, depression, self-harm. And now he has two Oscars from his film score work, including one with a Disney film, like a kid's film. So, you know,
playing to his lighter, brighter
side.
Yeah,
exactly. He's found happiness. And, you know, not forgetting then the incredible TV tune composers. So kind of Mike Post, I think, is like the John Williams of the TV world. He made the iconic Law and Order music, which people know, the dun-dun, you know. But also the A-Team, the Rockford Files, Magnum P.I., Doogie Howser, Hill Street Blues, and probably my favourite of all time, which was Quantum Leap. So just churned out these incredible TV themes over the years as well.
I'm going to have to go now after the show and listen to Eye of the Tiger by Survivor.
Yeah, we should listen to it before. Get yourself psyched up.
Every morning at 5 to 10.
You don't do that every morning?
And run up some steps as well before I come in. Adam, thanks so much. Adam McGuire there from the RT Business Desk. Now, how does our attitude to ageing impact our overall health? Well, Dr. Harry Barry and Anne-Marie Craven will be here to tell us more a bit later. But next, from costumes to decorations, how to make some sustainable swaps this Halloween.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.